From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. 77 people killed their intimate partner in North Carolina last year. 62% of those people used a firearm. That's according to the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence, a statewide nonprofit organization. A 2015 report by Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health says family and intimate assaults with firearms are 12 times more likely to result in death than non-firearm assaults. The 1996 federal domestic violence offender gun ban, otherwise known as the Lautenberg Amendment, does not allow a person convicted of a domestic violence charge to legally possess a gun. But the New York Times reports, in the two decades since, a large percentage of the perpetrators of mass shootings and other violent crimes have had run-ins with the law over spousal abuse and have had little problem acquiring deadly arsenals. With us to take a closer look at this issue today as it relates to North Carolina and the Cape Fear region, Mandy Hooveris. She is the Direct Services Outreach Director for Domestic Violence Shelter and Services. Mandy Hooveris, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you so much.
Erica Jones is Assistant District Attorney for New Hanover County and prosecutes all of the county's felony domestic violence cases. Erica Jones, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Amalie McCool is the Legal and Policy Director for the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence. She is a lawyer and a certified criminal justice instructor specializing in domestic violence and legal topics. Amalie McCool, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Rachel.
And we're inviting your questions on this Wednesday. What do you want to know about the intersection of guns and domestic violence? How do you think the legal system needs to change, does it need to change, to support and protect victims of domestic violence? You can call us during this live Wednesday edition at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. So to get our kind of heads around this, why guns are such a problem when it comes to domestic violence cases, let's start with a common hypothetical situation. There are so many potential variants in these situations, Mandy Hooveris, but let's start with, say, a woman who has been in an abusive relationship. She realizes it's escalated to the point where she's in very serious danger and she needs to get out, and she comes to you. So she's staying at your shelter. Do you counsel her to get a restraining order or not?
That's a great question, Rachel, and it's one that we deal with on a daily basis. What we know about domestic violence is that the root is about power and control, and also that each situation is very unique. And protective orders are wonderful tools that can help set boundaries and create consequences when those boundaries are crossed. And so with each client that we work with, one of the intake questions we ask are, do you want more information about obtaining a protective order? And we have staff who help with that on a daily basis.
Erica Jones, let's say this woman then has gone to take out a protective order. What are the steps along that path for her?
So she'll first motion the district court for what's called an ex parte order. And it's called ex parte because at that point, the person she's trying to get an order against will not be present. And so she'll be able to tell the judge, you know, what's happened. Were there any past acts of domestic violence? She'll be able to tell the judge whether the person has a weapon, all of those things that the judge will use to decide if it is necessary for an ex parte order to be granted. If it is granted at that point, the person who's going to get the order against him or her, because it could be a male or a female, will get notice of hearing. And at that point, they can hire an attorney who can represent them, or they can represent themselves. They can consent to the order, or they can present their own evidence before a district court judge. The judge does grant a year-long order. It's called Domestic Violence Protective Order. That's all a civil process. So no one from the district attorney's office is going to be present for either of those hearings. It's not actually a criminal matter until that order is violated. We have misdemeanor protective order violations. We have felony domestic order violations. And then that's the point when our office becomes involved.
Okay. Amalie McCool of the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Let's say this is the first time this woman has requested a restraining order or a protective order. And am I using those terms properly, by the way? Are they interchangeable?
Yeah. Yes, we use a lot of change words interchangeably, domestic violence protective order or 50B order, restraining order. A lot of times they get used interchangeably.
So she's already gotten up enough courage to leave. Mm-hmm. She's escaped. She's staying in the domestic violence shelter here in Wilmington. When she thinks about going to court to face her abuser, mm-hmm. and explain to the judge why this is a necessary protective order, that alone sounds like a scary moment for her if
absolutely.
She's already been abused.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the court process is inherently intimidating to folks who don't live and breathe in it. And in addition, most of the time, you know, even though at that first stage when a victim might go and request that initial order, like Erica said, it's what we call ex parte, meaning the other party's not there. Eventually, the other party does. I mean, they have notice and opportunity to be there. So, you know, victim can't get that full protective order without at least the chance that that abuser is going to come to court, that they're going to have to face them. They may even have to be directly cross-examined by them. It's a very intimidating process.
And so let's say that happens. Let's say the alleged abuser shows up and cross-examines our victim who, mm-hmm. who is asking for this protective order.
Yeah.
I can see a situation there, a woman saying, I'm provoking him even more. I just want to get away. So what yeah. would you advise her to do in that circumstance?
Absolutely. So a lot like Mandy said is that really within the domestic violence movement, we feel really strongly that survivors are the expert on their situation. So I wouldn't give really advice about what a survivor should or shouldn't do because it's really unique to every single person's situation. Instead, I would absolutely talk with that victim about what they think is best. What do they know about their partner? How do they think that their partner will react to this domestic violence protective order? Do they think that their abuser is someone who might be more likely to comply with this protective order and therefore it does sort of bolster their safety, or do they think it's something that might actually escalate and put them in more danger? And that is such an individualized decision. And so I would absolutely help with that conversation and that safety planning, but I would never advise a victim to absolutely get a protective order or absolutely not.
And, of course, Emily, you have said that after a woman gets a protective order, that can be the most dangerous time for her.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, any victim, you know, male or female who applies for a domestic violence protective order, they're necessarily in the process of leaving their abuser. And as Mandy said, right, domestic violence is about power and control. And so when a victim is in the process of leaving their abuser, that's when their abuser's power and control is most threatened. And so oftentimes that is when that abuser is more likely to take even more scary steps, really, to exercise their power and control. And research shows us time and time again that victims are actually in more danger of actually being killed when they're in the process of leaving or have left.
Mandy Hooverus.
And I think that's such an important point that we fail to consider a lot of times mm-hmm. as a society. I know many people that I work with are told over and over again, well, just leave. If it's yeah. terrible, then just leave. Why are you staying? And as an advocate, I never want someone to remain in a situation where they don't feel safe and they don't feel loved or valued. But at the same time, if it was as simple as just leaving, then people would just leave. And we wouldn't need this range of services and support. In actuality, leaving is one of the most dangerous times. And so it's very important that survivors feel supported, that they have a strong safety plan in place so that they know how to protect themselves.
Now, are there different degrees of protective orders? Erica Jones, you talked about the first step, which is the ex parte step. And then by the time it gets to you, by the time you're involved, we're talking about a felony, an alleged felony. Is that right?
Right. So there are felony protective order violations. The ones I prosecute most are when someone has two prior convictions. If you have two prior convictions for a misdemeanor protective order violation, at that point, it becomes a felony. So that's what I usually prosecute.
What is an example of a misdemeanor violation of a protective order?
And it can be something very simple. If the order says that you cannot, you know, have any contact, interfere, harass, threaten this person, and you call and say, you know, I'm going to get you. Something simple as that. It could be, you know, constant calling someone on their cell phone or sitting outside their workplace or sitting outside the house or honking your horn. Or, I mean, it could be a multitude of things.
Okay, so let's say it's risen to the level of a felony violation. And let's say that our hypothetical victim here knows that this abuser has firearms. Can this victim tell law enforcement about the firearms and have those firearms confiscated? Emily
sure.
McCool.
Actually, even before it gets to the level of a felony, victims can actually ask as part of a domestic violence protective order that firearms be removed from offenders. So there's a number of different provisions as part of a domestic violence protective order that relate to firearms. Some of them relate to asking the court to have an offender not be able to purchase firearms. And then there's separate remedies that a victim can ask that actually ask the court to order this offender to not possess firearms and to surrender firearms. Those actually are a little harder to get. The victim has to show the court that they are in a high-risk situation, that there's certain high-risk factors present. But
so wouldn't the need for the protective order be a proof that there's a risk present?
Well,
not so much. Okay.
Some of us would like that, yes.
All right, we're going to hear more about that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're talking about the intersection of guns and domestic violence and what victim advocates say needs to change in the legal system. If you have your own question, you can call us during this live Wednesday edition at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. 62% of intimate partner homicides last year in North Carolina involved a firearm. Today, we're exploring that intersection of guns and domestic violence and what other factors might contribute to lethal danger for a victim. Answering your questions on this Wednesday edition, Mandy Hooveris. She's the Director of Outreach and Direct Services for the Domestic Violence Shelter and Services. Erica Jones is an Assistant District Attorney in New Hanover County. And Emily McCool is Legal and Policy Director for the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence, a statewide nonprofit. You can either call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And I do want to make a note, I've been using female pronouns here and a woman in this hypothetical abuse scenario only because that's more common, but this is absolutely not necessarily a gendered issue. Mandy Hooveris?
Yeah, absolutely. So last year, we provided direct services to 41 men. We work with male clients every month. We know that this issue is about power and control. And by far, we serve more female victims. However, men can definitely be impacted by this. And so it's important that we keep open minds about who would be a victim of domestic violence and also who would be an abuser.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to where we left it at the end of the first segment, talking about a victim who has sought a protective order. She's in the first stage of this. And she knows that her partner in this case, her abusive partner, has a gun. And she's very afraid. Let's say that he's threatened her. So Emily McCool, can she just go to a judge and say, oh, he has a gun. Can you get that?
No. I mean, not just every victim can't do that. So after 2015, our North Carolina Court of Appeals, they ruled in a case, Stancil versus Stancil, that said that in order for the courts to actually order an abuser to surrender their firearms, that the court has to make a finding of fact that in this particular case, there is a high risk factor, and there's a number of those listed in our statute.
So can you explain why the need for the protective order in itself is not considered a high risk factor?
And so No. I guess reasonable people disagree. Honestly, before 2015, judges used their discretion, to be quite honest.
As to whether or not law enforcement would be confiscating firearms.
Absolutely. They would look at the facts of the case and decide whether or not this particular case called for the surrender of firearms. And there may have been a high risk factor as defined by the statute. There may not have been. But our judges have a vast majority of experience in working with domestic violence and judging the credibility of victims and hearing their histories and also just knowing this huge link between domestic violence and firearms. I feel like the research itself shows that there is enough and the danger to victims during this period and all of the things. But our statute, what it says is that if there's a high risk factor, the court shall remove firearms. So it actually removes their discretion, that if they find one of these risk factors, they have to remove firearms if the victim requests it. But our court actually interpreted that same language to say not only shall they, but that one of those risk factors has to be present. And that was a shift. Whereas before, our judges were removing firearms even without a high risk factor and their discretion.
So what are the high risk factors if it's not the order itself?
So there's a number of factors, things like if the abuser has threatened to commit suicide, if the abuser has a history of using a weapon or against the victim or threatening to use a weapon, if they've caused serious injury to the victim. So those are sort of the high risk factors. But it really makes it rise to a different level. The presence of the gun by itself is no longer enough, even though we know from the research, as you said, introducing the program today, that just the presence of a firearm in a home where the person has a history of domestic violence increases the risk of lethality to this victim by somewhere between 12%. Other studies show up to 20%. It's a statutory interpretation question. So our Court of Appeals, I want to be clear, it's not that they don't aren't worried about our victims, but that's the way they interpreted what our legislature wrote. And so the way to fix this is for our legislature to go back and say, oh, no, what we really meant was that you can, in the court's discretion, you can take firearms anytime you think it's appropriate. But that fix hasn't yet happened.
Mandy Hooverus.
And so it's very complicated. I mean, that's the takeaway. And a lot of times on the outside, when we look into these situations, we imagine how we think things go or how we think things should be. And that's why discussions like this are so important, because it's educating the public on how the system does work. And also my role as an advocate is educating the victim that I'm working with about the pros and cons of each option presented to him or her and the possible consequences.
And so there are times, Mandy Hooverus, when you will advise a victim of domestic violence not to get a protective order, even though she's terrified for her safety. There are circumstances.
And no, I would never not advise someone to get a protective order. And that's the beauty of the role of advocacy, is that we're here to educate and explore options with the clients that we serve, but I am never in a position of power to tell them what choice to make or not to make. The reality is we never have a crystal ball. As a society, we have this idea that if you call the police and you file a protective order and you prosecute, then all of those things will make you safe. And again, if that were the case universally, then we would always do those things. But unfortunately, there are victims of domestic violence who did all of those things that society says to do and ultimately lost their life. And so as advocates, it's very important that we stay present in the moment, listen to the clients we serve, and help them identify the individual safety factors that are going to be important.
Erica Jones, Assistant District Attorney in New Hanover County, as you prosecute these felony cases of domestic violence, do you frequently run across so-called victims who are lobbing accusations that are just designed to torture the alleged abuser? I mean, is it common for someone to go after their spouse? Let's go back to our hypothetical victim here. Is it possible that she's completely making this up and she just wants to torture him? Does that happen frequently?
I would say, of course, it's possible. I don't believe it's common. I don't even get the allegation very commonly from defense attorneys. I mean, usually it's a matter of the person may say, I don't want to go forward at this point, or they kind of get cold feet. But I don't get a lot of cases where the defense is claiming she made the whole thing up, she was upset. Of course, it's possible, but it's not something that I think is a common scenario in our office.
And what's your biggest frustration when prosecuting these cases? What's the biggest brick wall that you run into?
Kind of what I just talked about. So we have, you know, some victims, again, male or female, who may be gung-ho about prosecuting this case at the time because at that moment they're still physically hurting. They have the bruises, they have the scrapes, they're still in the emergency room, and they may say they want to go forward. But, you know, as those physical wounds heal and that person's no longer in the household and the kids may be asking, where's mommy, where's daddy, that conviction for wanting to go forward kind of goes away. And so they may call and say, well, you know, I've thought about it and we want to remain a family. And they may decide they don't want to go forward. Or you have the people who, even at the time, they're black and blue and bloodied, and they're still saying, I don't want to make this worse. I don't want to go forward. So when you have people who are, you know, they're in danger and they don't want to cooperate. And we get it. I mean, there are a million reasons why they may want to not go forward. They love this person. They may be financially dependent on this person. They have children with this person. They share family and friends. So many different reasons why, but you think this person's in danger and you want to be able to protect them, but you can't if they don't want to go forward.
Well, there are also no legal guarantees, right? So let's say they go forward and let's say this person doesn't get put behind bars, then suddenly your victim is in a lot more danger, right?
Absolutely. So I can never guarantee a conviction. I mean, we could have confession, you can have a video. We can never guarantee what a judge or a jury is going to say. In many situations, this won't be the first time that person was assaulted. And so they may say, oh, well, this is not the first time, so what makes this different? So I can never guarantee that a judge or a jury is going to find that defendant guilty. So they may be out there with no sort of conditions to keep them away from that person afterwards. Because I will say, even though we're talking about protective orders, sometimes we have no contact orders that are in place while case is pending. And that's another layer of protection, even aside from a protective order. Once that case is disposed, that goes away. So that person walks out of the courthouse like, what now? Can this person call me? And it's like, they absolutely can, unless something else arises later on.
And so, of course, people are entitled to due process. Our entire justice system is based on that idea, Emily McCool. But is there a way to shift the system so that it's a little more victim-centered, so that this person isn't putting potentially their lives at risk by testifying against their abuser? Or no?
You keep giving me these questions, and I'm like, nope. yes and no. I don't mean to be flip. There's definitely ways to do what I consider victim-centered prosecution that absolutely doesn't trample on the rights of offenders, on defendants, and making sure that we keep in mind, you know, due process and speedy trial and all the things and discovery and legal mumbo-jumbo stuff. But while still making sure that we try to have a victim-centered process, so there's definitely things that prosecutors do to make sure that when they proceed, it's victim-centered, like involving victims in the discussion about what would you like to see happen with this case and the disposition of the case, and when victims don't want to participate in prosecution, being, like Erica said, understanding about the reasons for that rather than proceeding then against the victim. Sometimes folks who aren't victim-centered may proceed against the victim then and issue what we call show cause orders and hold them in contempt of court for not participating, which then further re-victimizes victims. So while there's not a way to really shift it to be more balanced where the victim gets more rights than the defendant, there's definitely a way to prosecute in a way that doesn't, that minimizes the chance to re-victimize victims, if that makes sense.
Mandy Hooverus.
One of the wonderful things about our community is that it's about building relationships. And so as we're talking here today, right now, the Domestic Violence Advocacy Council is meeting at our office, and Erica Jones is a part of that group. And the purpose of that is to look at the coordinated community response to domestic violence here in our community. Part of that is for our advocates to get to know the people that our clients will encounter in the courthouse and to build those relationships. Victim witness legal assistants are imperative in that. They are the go-between between the victim and Erica and her office. And so letting clients know who the people who they'll be working with, what options they'll have ahead of time, really creates a more safe and supportive environment for the survivor who's navigating the criminal justice process.
And you keep emphasizing, well, all of you sort of emphasize the fact that it's the victim that needs to drive the process mm-hmm. and the decisions as they go along.
Absolutely. When we talk about this issue of power and control, victims have been made to feel powerless. They've been blamed for things. They've been isolated. And if an advocate, even hoping to do something positive, steps in and tells them what they have to do next, we're kind of reaffirming that message they've received from their abuser, that you can't figure this out, that you're not capable. And so we really try to adhere to an empowering philosophy where we give them back choice and support them through that.
Erica Jones.
And I struggle with that part. I absolutely agree, but in what I do, I always have to explain to victims that I don't represent them in an individual mm-hmm. capacity. Mm-hmm. So I represent the state of North Carolina. And so sometimes they may want something that may be make run counter to what I believe is necessary for the community. I may have someone who has an awful record, is an awful assault. There may be other witnesses, and it may be in a situation where I can actually prosecute without that victim having to testify. I've had those cases. And so I have to tell them, I understand what you're saying, but for, you know, the protection of the community, at this time, I will not dismiss that case. And so I always feel that sort of struggle, that sort of internal struggle between telling someone, I'm hearing you, but I'm not doing what you're saying, because they think, you know, this is the one time where I want to be able to say, you know, what my desires are, and this lady's not listening to me. So that's something I always say from the very beginning of our conversations.
I definitely agree with Erica on that. And the beautiful thing about this is that we do have different roles. We all bring a different piece to the table. And so as an advocate, I'm in a much different position where I'm just able to offer this unconditional support. Erica has a very different role in this. And we're so lucky to have an assistant district attorney who does care so much about victims and cares about this issue. But she has different challenges in her role. And so we work together to create a system, hopefully, that is supportive.
I want to go back to a circumstance where law enforcement might have been told, yes, you need to confiscate the weapons that this alleged abuser has. But first, you're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation about the intersection of gun and domestic violence. Here to answer your questions on this Wednesday, Amalie McCool, Legal and Policy Director for the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence, Erica Jones, Assistant District Attorney in New Hanover County, and Mandy Hooveris, Director of Outreach and Direct Services at the Domestic Violence Shelter and Services. If you have a question, you can call us during this live Wednesday edition at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. So, a judge has said, not only am I granting this protective order, but there are clearly high-risk factors, so any firearms in this abuser's possession need to be taken away. So, problem solved there. Right, Amalie McCool?
Easy peasy, Rachel. No. So, there are absolutely then things that law enforcement can do, and that's great. So it does. It gives law enforcement a tool to then try to confiscate those firearms. So the difficulty is that a domestic violence protective order that orders the surrender of firearms is not a search warrant. And what that means is that when law enforcement goes and serves that abuser with that domestic violence protective order, which says, hey, abuser, this says you have firearms, you need to give them up to us, the abuser can go, what firearms? I don't have firearms. And that protective order by itself does not give law enforcement the authority to say, move aside, abuser, let me go in your house and look for your firearms, because the domestic violence protective order is not a search warrant.
Okay, that makes sense. So then the law enforcement officers can go back and get a search warrant.
They sure can. That's a great idea, Rachel. They should go get a search warrant. The problem is it's you know, it's an extra step. And sometimes our law enforcement just, they're short on resources. I mean, and that's just the reality, is taking that extra step of going and applying for a search warrant takes time, and it takes being able to apply for that search warrant with specificity using the information in a protective order.
And so that onus would be on those law enforcement Correct. Officers who showed, they would be the ones that would have to get the search warrant.
That's right.
And that often doesn't happen.
Not that I hear of a lot. But I think that it can. And I think a lot of times it's honestly, it's a training issue and it's a resource issue, to be clear. It's not because our law enforcement don't care. It's that a lot of times they, no one's really said that to them, that said, hey, you can go do this extra step and get a search warrant.
They don't even know they have that option.
Well, I mean, I think maybe somewhere they might could stop and think about it, but they just haven't thought about it because it's just not what they've been trained to do. They've been trained to go serve the protective order, ask if they have firearms. If they don't have them, stop. You know? And so I think sometimes it's just a conversation about here are some other things you can do. Or even before you go serve the protective order, to actually check with, for instance, the gun permitting section of the Sheriff's Department, because those folks can say whether or not this offender actually has a gun permit that was issued to them. Because then if they already have that information, they know that that offender needs to either give up the gun permit or give up the gun, one or the other.
Well, let's say this offender doesn't have a permit, but he has guns. Let's say he doesn't much care about having a permit.
Sure.
And whether it's legal or not.
Absolutely.
So do we have statistics on, you know, if, say, law enforcement officials followed the steps all the way through? Let's just say in a perfect world they had unlimited resources. They knocked on the guy's door. He says, no guns here. They go back. They get a search warrant. Mm-hmm. They come back. They search his house and they confiscate his guns. Would that solve most of the homicides that occur in these cases?
No.
But certainly wouldn't hurt.
No, yeah. I mean, I can't say that it would solve most of them. But would it absolutely? I mean, what we're trying to do is reduce harm, is keep firearms out of the hands of abusers. And it would then kick it to Erica, because they could then charge them with the felony of possessing a firearm in violation of a protective order. So there's that another level.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of the domestic violence dynamic, why it's hard to leave, and why victims of domestic violence so often live in terror after they leave, terror that comes from real risk. We have three domestic violence advocates and experts with us today to look at some of the legal issues, the services available, and how the culture might change to a more victim-centered approach. After this break, you'll have one more segment to get your question in. On this Wednesday, call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today we're learning about lethal domestic violence, how victims can protect themselves, what policy experts say needs to change in the legal system. Answering your questions on this Wednesday, Amelie McCool, Legal and Policy Director for the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence, Erica Jones, Assistant District Attorney in New Hanover County, and Mandy Hooveris, Director of Outreach and Direct Services for the Domestic Violence Shelter and Services. This is the last segment, so you have just a few minutes to get your question in during this live Thursday edition. You can either call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And in a moment, I'm going to read an email from Peter who raises an interesting question. But first, before we went to break, we were talking about the fact that if law enforcement officials go to an abuser's door and say, you know, we have this order of protection and you need to surrender your firearms, and the abuser says, I don't have any, law enforcement then would need to go back and get a search warrant before they could take further steps to actually confiscate weapons that may exist. Mm-hmm. And that's an important piece of the puzzle. Mandy Hooveris?
Yeah, most certainly. And what we know is that there's not one change that would prevent all domestic violence homicides. We sure wish that there was, but we can look at our response as a community. We can look at other communities who've been innovative and look for new ways to do things. In 2015, there were 6,510 domestic violence 911 calls.
In what jurisdiction are we talking about?
In New Hanover County.
In New Hanover. Say that number again.
6,510 domestic violence calls to 911. And of those, 373 of them involved a weapon. And so that's one a day. And we know that it's happening here in our community. So we're poised to make some positive changes. we had an alarming increase in the rate of domestic violence homicides here in New Hanover County. And when that happened...
Over what period of time?
2017.
Last year, we had an alarming increase in the number of domestic violence homicides.
That's right. And when that happened, it's a tragedy and it hits all of us, especially those who do this work. But one of the things that really inspired me was we had our chief and our sheriff and our DA all reach out to us and say, this has to stop. We have to figure out new ways to work together surrounding this. And so even though we had a terrible year for this last year, I'm very inspired by the support of our community and feel that we are poised to make some really positive changes.
Why was 2017 so bad?
That's what we have to figure out. That's a really hard question to answer. There are other counties in North Carolina. Buncombe County, for instance, had a year where they had 14 DV homicides and it just skyrocketed. And someone on their, one of the county commissioners said, this can't happen. It has to stop. And so it really engaged that community to discuss what was going on and ways that they could work together to creatively solve it. And so we know that it can be done and we have the support of all of the people we need. And so just being here today and having this discussion in a public way, I think is a step in the right direction.
This email from Peter writes, as horrible as domestic violence is, I must ask the same question that Clarence Thomas asked from the bench. The Heller decision finally clarified the right to own firearms is an individual constitutional right. Are there any other constitutional rights that you would suspend based upon an allegation rather than due process and a conviction? For example, should the subject of a restraining order have his or her home searched without a warrant? We've already established that the answer to that is no, that's not what happens. Peter says, if we can waive a constitutional right based upon an allegation, then we can waive any constitutional right based on an allegation. Erica Jones, is this a slippery slope?
Well, I think the key word is allegation. And so we're not suspending any rights based on an allegation. So there's going to be a finding by a court. So you're either going to have a criminal conviction where a judge has decided that, you know, beyond reasonable doubt, this person is guilty of a domestic violence offense, or you have a jury saying that, or you can have a consent order. So it's not based on just an allegation that we are suspending any rights.
Well, but aren't you? Because if, say, when I go in this hypothetical situation to get an order of protection against my abuser and I tell the judge that he has a weapon and, you know, we haven't been through any kind of criminal case yet, but the judge determines there's a high risk factor here. And so the judge then says, law enforcement needs to serve the order of protection on the guy and take the weapon. Emily McCool,
yeah.
Isn't that suspending his constitutional rights before he's had due process?
So the issue is that there's actually legal remedies for temporary injunction. So that's the piece that we're missing here, is that our law allows the fact for there to be relief when there is imminent harm. And those are called temporary injunctions, which is what an ex parte is. Just like we suspend folks' constitutional rights to their children when judges issue emergency custody orders. So that's a parallel. And absolutely. And but to remember, I want to be really clear for all of our listeners that these temporary restraining orders are temporary. They're actually very short in time and that you have to return to court within 10 days. So this suspension, it's based on first the judge making a finding that there is enough to move forward. And judges deny ex partes all the time because they don't find enough to grant that temporary injunction. And even when they do, there has to be that return within 10 days for notice and opportunity to be heard. And our courts have found over and over again that that does meet the requirements of due process.
Mandy Hooverus.
I think it's also important to remember that when we provide court advocacy and we go with a plaintiff to court for a domestic violence protective order hearing, it is the plaintiff's burden to justify the entry of the order. And so there can be a misconception that if someone says that they were assaulted by their partner, that an immediate arrest happens and all of this just kind of snowballs just based on my word against their word. And the reality is It's a great burden to prove that there's a need for the order.
We have an email. Susan writes, abusers are not treated as severely as necessary. She says, I believe it's because domestic, they aren't treated with as the threat they pose. And she names somebody who will remain unnamed on this program. He beat his wife with a baseball bat that almost killed her, released on $100,000 bail, finally killed her with poison while she was still in the hospital from the beating 6 months later. Bail doesn't work for some of these animals. We have a couple of callers. Tom from Southport, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'm a firearms instructor, and so I deal with pistols and people and guns all the time. And the first thing that has to be said is that domestic violence is inexcusable, unacceptable, and needs to be stopped, period. So there's no confusion about this. The second thing, and I think this is important, when people talk about false allegations, the FBI says that about 3% of the allegations that are filed are false. And the general consensus is that allegations of domestic violence fit into that category. So you're talking about an incredibly small percentage of people who falsely file allegations of domestic violence for whatever reason. So it's a tiny little slice. That being said, firearms, and I just moved down here a few years ago from New York, where all the guns were supposed to be registered, and all mine were. Firearms in this environment are incredibly easy to get a hold of.
Do you mean in North Carolina? Is that what you're saying?
In North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. And there has been a push in the legislature.
This is not a second degree discussion, and I know that. So just leave it at firearms are incredibly easy to get a hold of. And so if somebody wants to get a gun and commit a violent act, they're going to have that ability. And so while it's tempting to focus on legislation to make it illegal to do things, I don't think that those, from a practical perspective, are going to do much to stop the 7,000 deaths we have a year that are firearm related, with where it's a partner or spouse that gets who pays the price. So I believe that education on this is far more important than the legislation. Statements like what, you know, how could it hurt? It hurts because people who own firearms, who aren't violent, who don't create problems, see those restrictions coming in, realize they don't stop the problem, which is violent people hurting other people. And so they look at this as an infringement on that. They're almost unfairly being accused of something because they own a firearm.
And Tom, you actually raise a really interesting point here, because I know that people who are passionate Second Amendment supporters and who have worked for the right to bear arms, especially in North Carolina, and there has been, you know, movement in the legislature along those lines over the last several years, might see this discussion as one of the doors to shutting down that right to arm oneself. Emily McCool, what would you say to Tom? Is there an intersection here? Are we closing a door on law-abiding citizens' right to bear arms? Thanks so much for your call, Tom.
Yeah, and first of all, I also want to thank Tom for his call and for pointing out about the fact that domestic violence has the same rate of false allegations of around 3% as any other crime. I think that's a really important point. So thank you for that, Tom. I would say that I would echo honestly what Mandy said earlier, is that this is one tool, and we absolutely recognize that there are offenders who are going to get firearms through a non-legal process.
Right.
But I do believe that legislation can help. Excuse me, I apologize. In fact, research has shown that, for instance, the Lautenberg Amendment, which is the federal rule, the prohibition on offenders who have misdemeanor convictions of domestic violence, that research has shown that the enforcement of the Lautenberg Amendment has reduced female partner homicide by 17% and has reduced domestic child homicide by 25%. So while I absolutely agree that it's not the end-all solution, I do believe that is a tool, and it's one that we should pursue in trying to find a patchwork of solutions to how can we keep people safer. And I think that folks who believe in the right to bear arms are usually, like Tom, they're with us. And what his first statement was about domestic violence is unacceptable. And they can get behind the fact that folks who have committed domestic violence and who are dangerous should not have firearms. And I'm not one of them. I get to have my firearms. But those folks, there should be legal remedies to keep firearms out of the hands of abusers. And so I think that most folks can see that difference and support us. One of the things that I love about being in the domestic violence world is it is a bipartisan topic, and that folks on both sides of the aisle oftentimes can really get behind legislation to keep people safer.
Is there legislation that you're working on that you're hoping will come up in the next session that would address some of these issues?
We would be looking at 2019, because really the short session is not for introducing new legislation, but we certainly are looking and talking to multiple partners about what can we do to strengthen laws to keep victims safer. And some of those have to do with firearms, and some of them have to do with employment protections, and there's lots of things out there to keep victims safer, but strengthening our laws around firearms is definitely one of them.
Mandy Hooverus.
You know, I think Emily makes a lot of really good points, and we're not opposed to people having guns. It's not a conversation, at least for me personally, on whether or not someone should or shouldn't have a gun. We do know, like when I do an intake with a client, one of the questions we ask is there a weapon in the home? Do you own a weapon, or does the abuser own a weapon? Because we know that that raises that lethality risk. We also ask a lot of other questions about those kind of high-risk behaviors that Emily already talked about. And so I think it's important that we have discussions, that we listen, and that we continue to work towards a solution.
And briefly, we have Jim from Ocean Isle. Welcome to Coastline, Jim. You're on the air.
How are you doing today?
Good, thanks. Do you have a question?
Well, I just have a point of observation. I was a police officer in another state, and before the 209A abuse order, protective orders came out, we had very few homicides. As soon as the law came in, if there was any signs of abuse, we had to arrest. A restraining order was issued, and we were allowed to seize any and all weapons. And when I say seize, crossbows, you name it, knives, anything and everything at that time, even though there wasn't a hearing, we were allowed to legally seize it. The second thing I want to mention, as soon as this law went into effect, we saw a spike, a tremendous spike of homicides and domestic violence that ended in death. And in my point of view was there was never any counseling for the couple, especially with separation. There was a lot of children involved, and there was nothing. Even though you're not going to try to get this couple together, I think the male or the other partner, male and woman, need separation counseling.
Okay, Jim, we're running out of time. Thank you so much for that call. Mandy Hooverus, counseling, couples counseling in a domestic violence situation?
So we get that question a lot, and usually by the time someone walks into my office, they've exhausted every other opportunity option that they could think of. It's a hard door to walk through, and it's one that no one really plans on walking through. And so we get asked a lot about couples counseling and domestic violence. That can actually really escalate danger. There are ways to rehabilitate offenders and to support and address all those concerns, but couples counseling can be a dangerous option.
And we're going to put on our website services for victims of domestic violence. If you're concerned about your own safety and you're looking for a place to go, we'll put those up at whqr.org. That's this edition of Coastline. Mandy Hooverus Erica Jones, Amelie McCool, thank you all so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer Rachel Keith. Caitlin Hanrahan was today's chief engineer. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org, get the podcast, or find it on the HQR app. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.